This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1. RC-62713. Sutri. By Cormac McCarthy. Copyright 1979 by Cormac McCarthy. Read by Michael Kramer. Dear friend, now in the dusty, clockless hours of the town, when the streets lie black and steaming in the wake of the water trucks, and now when the drunk and the homeless have washed up in a lee of walls and alleys or abandoned lots, and cats go forth high-shouldered and lean in the grim perimeters about, now in these soot-blacked brick or cobbled corridors where light-wire shadows make a gothic harp of cellar doors, no soul shall walk save you. Old stone walls, unplumbed by weathers, lodged in their striae fossil bones, limestone scarabs rocked in the floor of this once inland sea. Thin dark trees through yon iron palings where the dead keep their own small metropolis. Curious marble architecture, stele and obelisk and cross, and little rain-worn stones where names grow dim with years. Earth packed with samples of the casket maker's trade, the dusty bones and rotted silk, the death wear stained with carrion. Out there under the blue lamplight, the trolley tracks run on to darkness, curved like cockheels in the pinchbeck dust. The steel leaks back the day's heat. You can feel it through the floors of your shoes. Past these corrugated warehouse walls down little sandy streets, where blown-out autos sulk on pedestals of cinder block, through warrens of sumac and pokeweed and withered honeysuckle, giving on to the scored clay banks of the railway. Gray vines coiled leftward in this northern hemisphere, what winds them shapes the dog whelk's shell. Weeds sprouted from cinder and brick, a steam shovel reared in solitary abandonment against the night sky. Cross here. By frog rails and fish plates where engines cough like lions in the dark of the yard. To a darker town, past lamps, stoned blind, past smoking oblique shacks and china dogs and painted tires where dirty flowers grow, down pavings rent with ruin, the slow cataclysm of neglect, the wires that belly pole to pole across the constellations hung with kite string, with bolos composed of hobbled bottles, or the toys of the smaller children. Encampment of the damned, precincts, perhaps, where dripping lepers prowl unbelled. Above the heat and the improbable skyline of the city, a brass moon has risen, and the clouds run before it like watered ink. The buildings stamped against the night are like a rampart to a farther world forsaken, old purposes forgot. Countrymen come for miles with the earth clinging to their shoes, and sit all day like mutes in the marketplace. This city, constructed on no known paradigm, a mongrel architecture reading back through the works of man in a brief delineation of the aberrant, disordered, and mad. A carnival of shapes upreared on the river plain that has dried up the sap of the earth for miles about. Factory walls of old dark brick, tracks of a spur line grown with weeds, a course of foul blue drainage where dark filaments of nameless dross sway in the current. Tin panes among the glass and the rusted window frames. There is a moon-shaped rictus in the street lamp's globe where a stone has gone, and from this aperture there drifts down through the constant helix of aspiring insects a faint and steady rain of the same forms, burnt and lifeless. Here at the creek mouth the fields run on to the river, the mud delted and bearing out of its rich alluvial harbored bones and dread waste a rack of crate wood and condoms and fruit rinds. Old tins and jars and ruined household artifacts that rear from the fecal mire of the flats like landmarks in the trackless vales of dementia precocks. A world beyond all fantasy, malevolent and tactile and dissociate, the blown light bulbs like shorn polyps, semi-translucent and skull-colored, bobbing blindly down, and spectral eyes of oil, and now and again the bleached and stinking forms of fetal humans bloated like young birds, moon-eyed and bluish or stale gray. Beyond in the dark, the river flows in a sluggard ooze toward southern seas, running down out of the rain-flattened corn and petty crops and river-loam gardens of upcountry landkeepers, grading along like bone dust, a freight with the past, dreams dispersed in the water some way, nothing ever lost. Houseboats ride at their hawsers. The neap mud along the shore lies ribbed and slick like the cavernous flitch of some beast hugely foundered. And beyond, the country rolls away to the south and the mountains, where hunters and woodcutters once slept in their boots by the dying light of their thousand fires, and went on, old Teutonic forebears with eyes incandesced by the visionary light of a massive rapacity, wave on wave of the violent and the insane, their brains stoked with spoorless analogues of all that was, lean Aryans with their abrogate Semitic chapbook reenacting the dramas and parables therein, and mindless and pale with a longing that nothing save Dark's total restitution could appease. We are come to a world within the world, in these alien reaches, these maugre sinks and interstitial wastes, that the righteous see from carriage and car another life dreams. Ill-shapen, or black, or deranged, fugitive of all order, strangers in every land. The night is quiet, like a camp before battle, the city beset by a thing unknown, and will it come from forest or sea? The Muringers have walled the pale, the gates are shut, but lo, the thing's inside, and can you guess his shape? Where he's kept, or what's the counter of his face? Is he a weaver, bloody shuttle shot through a time warp, a carter of souls from the world's nap? Or a hunter with hounds? Or do bone horses draw his dead cart through the streets, and does he call his trade to each? Dear friend, he is not to be dwelt upon, for it is by just such wise that he's invited in. The rest, indeed, is silence. It has begun to rain, light summer rain. You can see it falling slant in the town lights. The river lies in a grail of quietude. Here from the bridge, the world below seems a gift of simplicity. Curious no more. Down there in grots of fallen light, a cat transpires from stone to stone across the cobbles, liquid black, and sown in rapid antipodes over the rain-dark street, to vanish cat and counter-cat in the rifted works beyond. Faint summer lightning far down river. A curtain is rising on the western world. A fine rain of soot, dead beetles, anonymous small bones. The audience sits webbed in dust. Within the gutted sockets of the interlocutor's skull, a spider sleeps, and the jointed ruins of the hanged fool dangle from the flies, bone pendulum in motley. Four-footed shapes go to and fro over the boards. Ruder forms survive. Peering down into the water where the morning sun fashioned wheels of light, coronets fanwise, in which lay trapped each twig, each grain of sediment, long flakes and blades of light in the dusty water sliding away like optic strobes, where motes sifted and spun. A hand trails over the gunwale, and he lies athwart the skiff, the toe of one sneaker plucking periodic dimples in the river with the boat's slight cradling, drifting down beneath the bridge and slowly past the mud-stained stanchions. Under the high, cool arches and dark keeps of the span's undercarriage, where pigeons babble and the hollow flap of their wings echoes in stark applause. Glancing up at these cathedraled vaultings, with their fossil wood knots and pseudomorphic nail-heads in gray concrete, drifting, the bridge's slant shadow leaning the width of the river with that headlong illusion postulate in old cup racers, frozen on photoplates, their wheels elliptic with speed. These shadows form over the skiff, accommodate his prone figure, and pass on. With his jaw cradled in the crook of his arm, he watched idly surface phenomena, gouts of sewage faintly working, gray clots of nameless waste and yellow condoms roiling slowly out of the murk like some giant form of fluke or tapeworm. The watcher's face rode beside the boat, a sepia visage yawing in the scum, eyes veering and watery grimace. A welt curled sluggishly on the river's surface as if something unseen had stirred in the deeps, and small bubbles of gas erupted in oily spectra. Below the bridge, he eased himself erect, took up the oars, and began to row toward the south bank. There he brought the skiff about, swinging the stern into a clump of willows, and going aft, he raised up a heavy cord that ran into the water from an iron pipe driven into the mud of the bank. This he relayed through an open oarlock mounted on the skiff's transom. Now he set out again, rowing slowly, the cord coming up wet and smooth through the lock, and dipping into the river again. When he was some 30 feet from shore, the first dropper came up, doubling the line until he reached and cast it off. He went on, the skiff lightly quartered against the river's drift, the hooks riding up one by one into the oarlock with their leached and tattered gobbets of flesh. When he felt the weight of the first fish, he shipped the dripping oars and took hold of the line and brought it in by hand. A large carp broke water, a coarse mailed flank, dull bronze and glinting. He braced himself with one knee and hefted it into the boat, and cut the line and tied on a fresh hook with a chunk of cut bait and dropped it over the side, and went on, sculling with one oar, the carp warping heavily against the floorboards. When he had finished running the line, he was on the other side of the river. He rebaited the last drop and let the heavy cord go, watching it sink in the muddy water, among a spangled nimbus of sun motes, a broken corona up through which flared for a moment the last pale chunk of rancid meat. Shifting the oars aboard, he sprawled himself over the seats again to take the sun. The skiff swung gently, drifting in the current. He undid his shirt to the waist and put one forearm to his eyes. He could hear the river talking softly beneath him, heavy old river with wrinkled face. Beneath the sliding water, cannons and carriages, trunnions seized and rusting in the mud, keelboats rotted to the consistency of mucilage. Fabled sturgeons with their horny pentagonal bodies, the cupreous and day-sprite carp and catfish with their pale and spruless underbellies, a thick muck shot with broken glass, with bones and rusted tins and bits of crockery, reticulate with mud-black crazings. Across the river, the limestone cliffs reared gray and roughly faceted, and strung with grass across their face in thin green faults. Where they overhung the water, they made a cool shade, and the surface lay calm and dark and reflected like a small white star the form of a plover hovering on the updrafts off the edge of the bluff. Under the seat of the skiff, a catfish swam dry and intransigent, with his broad face pressed to the bulkhead. Passing the creek mouth, he raised one hand and waved slowly, the old blacks all flowered and bonneted, coming about like a wind-tilted garden with their canes bobbing and their arms lifting dark and random into the air, and their gaudy and barbaric costumes billowing with the movement. Beyond them, the shape of the city rising wore a wrought, a jaded look, hammered out dark and smoking against a china sky. The grimy river littoral lay warped and shimmering in the heat, and there was no sound in all this lonely summer forenoon. Below the railway trestle, he set to running his other line. The water was warm to the touch and had a granular lubricity like graphite. It was full noon when he finished, and he stood in the skiff for a moment looking over the catch. He came back upriver, rowing slowly, the fish struggling in a thin gray bilge in the floor of the boat, their soft barbels fingering with dull wonder the slimed boards, and their backs where they bowed into the sunlight already bleached a bloodless pale. The brass oarlocks creaked in their blocks, and the river water curled from the bow planks with a viscid quality and lay behind the skiff in a wake like plowed mire. He rowed up from under the shadow of the bluffs and past the sand and gravel company, and then along by barren and dusty lots where rails ran on cinder beds and boxcars oxidized on blind sidings, past warehouses of galvanized and corrugated tin set in flats gouged from the brick-colored earth, where rhomboid and volute shapes of limestone jutted all brindled with mud like great bones washed out. He had already started across the river when he saw the rescue boats against the bank. They were trolling in the channel while a small crowd watched from the shore. Two white boats, lightly veiled in the heat and the slow blue smoke of their exhaust, a faint chug of motors carrying the calm of the river. He crossed and rode up the edge of the channel. The boats had come alongside each other, and one of them had cut the engine. The rescue workers wore yachting caps and moved gravely at their task. As the fishermen passed, they were taking aboard a dead man. He was very stiff, and he looked like a window dummy, save for his face. The face seemed soft and bloated, and wore a grappling hook in the side of it, and a crazed grin. They raised him so, gambrelled up by the bones of his cheek. A pale, incruent wound. He seemed to protest woodenly, his head awry. They lifted him onto the deck, where he lay in his wet seersucker suit and his lemon-colored socks, leering wall-eyed up at the workers, with the hook in his face like some gross water homunculus taken in trolling that the light of God's day had stricken dead instanter. The fisherman went past and pulled the skiff into the bank upriver from the crowd. He rolled a stone over the rope and walked down to watch. The rescue boat was coming in, and one of the workers was kneeling over the corpse trying to pry the grapnel loose. The crowd was watching him, and he was sweating and working at the hook. Finally, he set his shoe against the dead man's skull and wrenched the hook with both hands until it came away trailing a stringy piece of blanched flesh. They brought him ashore on a canvas litter and laid him in the grass, where he stared at the sun with his drained eyes and his smile. A snarling clot of flies had already accrued out of the vapid air. The workers covered the dead man with a coarse gray blanket. His feet stuck out. The fisherman had made to go when someone in the crowd took his elbow. "Hey, Sutry." He turned. "Hey, Joe," he said. "Did you see it?" "No. They say he jumped last night. They found his shoes on the bridge." They stood looking at the dead man. The squad workers were coiling their ropes and seeing to their tackle. The crowd had come to press about like mourners, and the fisherman and his friend found themselves going past the dead man as if they'd pay respects. He lay there in his yellow socks, with the flies crawling on the blanket and one hand stretched out on the grass. He wore his watch on the inside of his wrist, as some folks do, or used to, and as Sutry passed, he noticed with a feeling he could not name that the dead man's watch was still running. "That's a bad way to check out," said Joe. "Let's go." They walked along the cinders by the edge of the railroad. Sutry rubbed the gently pulsing muscle in his speculative jaw. "Which way do you go?" said Joe. "Right here. I've got my boat."
"Are you still fishing?"
"Yeah."
"What made you take that up?"
"I don't know," Sutry said. "It seemed like a good idea at the time."
"You ever get uptown?"
"Sometimes."
"Why don't you come out to the corner some evening, and we'll drink a beer?"
"I'll get out there one of these days."
"You fishing today?"
"Yeah, a little." Joe was watching him.
"Listen," he said. "You could get on up at Miller's. Brother said they needed somebody in men's shoes."
Sutry looked at the ground and smiled and wiped his mouth at the back of his wrist and looked up again. "Well," he said, "I guess I'll just stick to the river for a while yet."
"Well, come out some evening."
"I will." They lifted each a hand in farewell, and he watched the boy go on up the tracks and then across the fields toward the road. Then he went down to the skiff and pulled the rope up and tossed it in and pushed off into the river again. The dead man was still lying on the bank under his blanket, but the crowd had begun to drift away. He rowed on across the river. He swung the skiff in beneath the bridge and shipped the oars and sat looking down at the fish. He selected a blue cat and fetched it up by the gill slots, his thumb resting in the soft yellow throat. It flexed once and was still. The oars dripped in the river. He climbed from the skiff and tied up at a stob and labored up the slick, grassless bank toward the arches where the bridge went to earth. Here, a dark cavern beneath the vaulted concrete, with rocks piled about the entrance and a crudely lettered "Keep Out" sign slashed in yellow paint across a boulder. A fire burned in a stone cairn on the rank and sunless clay, and there was an old man squatting before it. The old man looked up at him and looked back at the fire again. "I brought you a catfish," Sutri said. He mumbled and waved his hand about. Sutri laid the fish down, and the old man squinted at it, and then poked among the ashes of the fire.
"Sit down," he said.
He squatted. The old man watched the thin flames. Slow traffic passed above them in a muted rumble. In the fire, potatoes blistered and split their charred jackets with low hissing sounds, like small organisms expiring on the coals. The old man speared them from the ashes, 1, 2, 3 black stones, smoking. He grouped them in a rusty hubcap.
"Get ye a tater," he said.
Sutri lifted a hand. He did not answer because he knew that the old man would offer 3 times, and he must parcel out his words of refusal. The old man had tilted a steaming can and was peering inside. A handful of beans boiled in river water. He raised his ruined eyes and looked out from under the beam of tufted bone that shaded them.
"I remember you now," he said, "from when you was just little."
Sutri didn't think so, but he nodded. The old man used to go from door to door, and he could make the dolls and bears to talk.
"Go on, get ye a tater," he said.
"Thanks," said Sutri. "I've already eaten." Raw steam rose from the mealy pith of the potato he broke in his hands. Sutri looked out toward the river.
"I like a hot dinner, don't you?"
the old man said. Sutri nodded. Arched sumac fronds quivered in the noon warmth, and pigeons squabbled and crooned in the bridge's ribbed spandrels. The shadowed earth in which he squatted bore the stale odor of a crypt.
"You didn't see that man jump, did you?"
Sutri said. He shook his head, an old rag picker, his thin chops wobbling.
"I seen him dragging," he said. "Did they find him?"
"Yes."
"What did he jump for?"
"I don't guess he said."
"I wouldn't do it, would you?"
"I hope not. Did you go over in town this morning?"
"Nope. I never went. I've been too poorly to go."
"What's the matter?"
"Lord, I don't know. They say death comes like a thief in the night. Where is he? I'll hug his neck."
"Well, don't jump off the bridge."
"I wouldn't do it for nothing."
"They always seem to jump in hot weather."
"There's worse weather to come," said the ragpicker. "Hard weather. Be foretold."
"Did that girl come out to see you?"
"Ain't been nobody to see me."
He was eating the beans from the tin with a brass spoon.
"I'll talk to her again," said Sutri. "Well, I wish you'd get you one of these here taters."
Sutri rose. "I've got to get on," he said.
"Don't rush off."
"Got to go."
"Come back."
"All right." A slight wind had come up, and going back across the river, he braced his feet against the uprights in the stern and pulled hard. The skiff had shipped enough water through her ill-joined planks to float the morning's catch, and they wandered over the cupped and paint-chipped floorboards, colliding dumbly. Rag ends of caulking string flared from the seams and ebbed in the dirty water among bits of bait and paper, and the sweeps dipped and rose, and a constant sipe of river water sang from under the tin of one patched blade. Half awash as she was, the skiff wallowed with a mercurial inertia and made heavy going. He turned upriver close to shore and went on. Black families in bright Sunday clothes, fishing at the river's brim, watched somberly his passage. Dinner pails and baskets adorned the grass, and dark infants were displayed on blankets kept at their corners by stones against the wind. When he reached the houseboat, he shipped the oars, and the skiff slewed to a stall and settled ponderously against the tire casings nailed there. He swung himself up with the rope in one hand and made fast. The skiff bobbed and slid heavily, and the bilge water surged. The fish sculled sluggishly. Sutri stretched and rubbed his back and eyed the sun. It was already very hot. He went along the deck and pushed open the door and entered. Inside the shanty, the boards seemed buckled with the heat, and beads of pitch were dripping from the beams under the tin roof. He crossed the cabin and stretched himself out on the cot, closing his eyes, a faint breeze from the window stirring his hair. The shanty boat trembled slightly in the river, and one of the steel drums beneath the floor expanded in the heat with a melancholy bong. Eyes resting. This hushed and mazy Sunday, the heart beneath the breastbone pumping, the blood on its appointed rounds, life in small places, narrow crannies. In the leaves, the toad's pulse, the delicate cellular warfare in a water drop. A dextrocardiac, said the smiling doctor. Your heart's in the right place. Weather shrunk and loveless. The skin drawn and split like an overripe fruit. He turned heavily on the cot and put one eye to a space in the rough board wall. The river flowing past out there. Cloaca maxima. Death by drowning. The ticking of a dead man's watch. The old tin clock on grandfather's table hammered like a foundry. Leaning to say goodbye in the little yellow room, reek of lilies and incense. He arched his neck to tell me something. I never heard. He wheezed my name. His grip belied the frailty of him. His caved and wasted face. The dead would take the living with them if they could. I pulled away. Sat in an ivy garden that lizards kept with constant leathery slitherings. Hutched hairs, ghost pale in the shade of the carriage house wall. Flagstones in a rose garden, the terraced slope of the lawn above the river, odor of boxwood and moss mold, and old brick in the shadow of the spring house, under the watercress stones in the clear flowage cluttered with periwinkles. A salamander, trout-speckled, leaning to suck the cold and mossy water. A wrinkled child's face watching back, a watery isomer agoggle in the rings. In my father's last letter, he said that the world is run by those willing to take the responsibility for the running of it. If it is life that you feel you are missing, I can tell you where to find it. In the law courts, in business, in government. There is nothing occurring in the streets, nothing but a dumb show composed of the helpless and the impotent. From all old seamy throats of elders, musty books, I've salvaged not a word. In a dream, I walked with my grandfather by a dark lake, and the old man's talk was filled with incertitude. I saw how all things false fall from the dead. We spoke easily, and I was humbly honored to walk with him deep in that world where he was a man like all men. From the small end of a corridor in the autumn woods, he watched me go away to the world of the waking. If our dead kin are sainted, we may rightly pray to them. Mother Church tells us so. She does not say that they'll speak back, in dreams or out, or in what tongue the stillborn might be spoken. More common visitor, silent, the infant's ossetor, the thin and brindled bones along whose sulcate facets clove old shreds of flesh and cerements of tattered swaddle. Bones that would no more than fill a shoebox, a bulbous skull. On the right temple, a mauve half-moon. Sutri turned and lay staring at the ceiling, touching a like mark on his own left temple gently with his fingertips. The ordinary of the second sun. Mirror image. Gauche carbon. He lies in Woodlawn, whatever be left of the child with whom you shared your mother's belly. He neither spoke nor saw, nor does he now. Perhaps his skull held seawater. Born dead and witless both, or a teratoma grisly in form. No. For we were like to the last hair. I followed him into the world, me. A breech birth, hind end four in common with whales and bats, life forms meant for other mediums than the earth and having no affinity for it. And used to pray for his soul days past, believing this ghastly circus reconvened elsewhere for all time, he in the limbo of the Christless righteous, I in a terrestrial hell. Through the thin and riven wall, sounds of fish surging in the sinking skiff, the sign of faith. 12th house of the heavens, ushering in the Western Church. St. Peter, patron of fishmongers. St. Fiacre, that of piles. Sutri placed one arm across his eyes. He said that he might have been a fisher of men in another time, but these fish now seemed task enough for him. It was late evening before he woke. He did not stir, lying there on the rough army blanket, watching the licking shapes of light from the river's face lapse and flare over the ceiling. He felt the shanty tilt slightly, steps on the catwalk, and a low trundling sound among the barrels. No shade this. Through the cracks he could see someone coming along the walk. A timorous tapping, once again. "Come in," he said.
"Buddy?"
He turned his head. His uncle was standing in the doorway. He looked back at the ceiling, blinked, sat up, and swung his feet to the floor. "Come in, John," he said. The uncle came through the door, looking about, hesitant. He stopped in the center of the room, arrested in the quadrate bar of dusty light, davited between the window and its skewed replica on the far wall, a barren countenance cruelly lit, eyes watery and half-closed with their slack pendules of flesh hanging down his cheeks. His hands moved slightly with the wooden smile he managed.
"Hey, boy," he said.
Sutri sat looking at his shoes. He folded his hands together, opened them again, and looked up. "Sit down," he said. The uncle looked about, pulled the one chair back, and sat carefully in it.
"Well," he said, "how are you, buddy?"
"Like you see. How are you?"
"Fine, fine. How is everything going?"
"All right. How did you find me?"
"I saw John Clancy up at the Eagles, and he said that you were living in a houseboat or something, so I looked along the river here and found you."
He was smiling uncertainly. Sutri looked at him.
"Did you tell them where I was?"
He stopped smiling.
"No, no," he said, "no. That's your business."
"All right.
How long have you been down here?"
Sutri studied with a cold face the tolerant amusement his uncle affected.
"Since I got out," he said. "Well, we hadn't heard anything. How long has it been?"
"Who's we?"
"I hadn't heard. I mean, I didn't know for sure if you were even out or not."
"I got out in January."
"Good, good. What, do you rent this or what?"
"I bought it."
"Well, good."
He was looking about.
"Not bad. Stove and all."
"How have you been, John?"
"Oh, I can't complain. You know."
Sutri watched him. He looked made up for an older part, hair streaked with chalk, his face a clay mask, cracked in a footman's smile. "You're looking well," said Sutri. A tick jerked his mouth corner.
"Well, thanks, thanks. Try to keep fit, you know. Old liver, not the best."
He put the flat of his hand to his abdomen, looked up toward the ceiling, out the window where the shadows had grown long toward night.
"Had an operation back in the winter. I guess you didn't know."
"No."
"I'm pulling out of it, of course."
Sutri could smell him in the heat of the little room. The rank odor of his clothes touched with a faint reek of whiskey, sweet smell of death at the edges. Behind him, in the western wall, the candled wood knots shone blood red and incandescent like the eyes of watching fiends.
"I don't have a drink, or I'd offer you one."
The uncle raised a palm.
"No, no," he said. "Not for me, thanks."
He lowered one brow at Sutri.
"I saw your mother," he said.
Sutri didn't answer. The uncle was pulling at his cigarettes. He held out the pack.
"Cigarette?"
he said.
"No, thanks."
He shook the pack.
"Go ahead."
"I don't smoke."
"You used to." "I quit."
The uncle lit up and blew smoke in a thin blue viper's breath toward the window. It coiled and diffused in the yellow light. He smiled.
I'd like to have a dollar for every time I quit, he said. Anyway, they're all fine. Thought I'd let you know.
I didn't think you saw them.
I saw your mother uptown.
You said.
Well, I don't get out there much, of course. I went at Christmas, you know. They left word at the Eagles for me to call one time, and I don't know, come to dinner sometime, you know. I didn't want to go out there.
I don't blame you for that. The uncle shifted a little in his chair.
Well, it's not that I don't get along with them, really. I just...
You just can't stand them, nor them you. A funny little smile crossed the uncle's face.
Well, he said, I don't think I'd go so far as to say that. Now, of course, they've never done me any favors.
Tell me about it, said Suttree dryly.
I guess that's right,
the uncle said, nodding his head. He sucked deeply on his cigarette, reflecting.
I guess you and me have a little in common there, eh, boy?
He thinks so.
You should have known my father. He was a fine man.
The uncle was looking down at his hands uncertainly.
Yes, he said, a fine man.
I remember him.
He died when you were a baby.
I know. The uncle took another tack.
You ought to come up to the Eagles some night, he said.
I could get you in.
They have a dance on Saturday night. They have some good-looking women come up there. You'd be surprised.
I guess I would. Suttree had leaned back against the raw plank wall. A blue dusk filled the little cabin. He was looking out the window where nighthawks had come forth, and swifts shied chittering over the river.
You're a funny fella, buddy. I can't imagine anyone being more different from your brother.
Which one?
What?
I said, which one?
Which what?
Which brother? The uncle chuckled uneasily.
Why, he said, you've just got the one, Carl.
Couldn't they think of a name for the other one?
What other one? What in the hell are you talking about?
The one that was born dead.
Who told you that?
I remembered it.
Who told you?
You did.
I never. When did I?
Years ago. You were drunk.
I never did.
All right, you didn't.
What difference does it make?
I don't know. I just wondered why it was supposed to be a secret. What did he die of?
He was stillborn. I know that. I don't know why. He just was. You were both premature. You swear I told you?
It's not important. You won't say anything, will you?
No.
I was just wondering about it. What the doctor says, for instance. I mean, you have to take them both home. Only one you take in a bag or a box. I guess they have people to take care of these things.
Just don't say anything.
Suttree was leaning forward, looking down at his cheap and rotting shoes where they lay crossed on the floor.
God, John, don't worry about it. I won't. Okay.
Don't tell them you saw me.
Okay. Fair enough. That's a deal.
Right, John. A deal.
I don't see them anyway.
So you said. The uncle shifted in the chair and pulled at his collar with a long yellow forefinger.
He could have helped me, you know. I never asked him for anything. Never did, by God. He could have helped me.
Well, said Suttree, he didn't. The uncle nodded, watching the floor.
You know, he said, you and me are a lot alike.
I don't think so.
In some ways.
No, said Suttree. We're not alike.
Well, I mean...
The uncle waved his hand. That's his thesis, but I'm not like you.
Well, you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, but I'm not like you, I'm not like him, I'm not like Carl. I'm like me. Don't tell me who I'm like.
Well, now look, buddy, there's no need.
I think there is a need. I don't want you down here, either. I know they don't like you. He doesn't. I don't blame you. It's not your fault. I can't do anything. The uncle narrowed his eyes at Sutri.
No need to get on your high horse with me, he said. At least I was never in the goddamn penitentiary.
Sutri smiled. The workhouse, John, it's a little different. But I am what I am. I don't go around telling people that I've been in a TB sanitarium.
So, I don't claim to be a teetotaler, if that's what you're getting at.
Are you an alcoholic?
No.
What are you smiling at?
I'm no goddamned alcoholic.
He always called you a rummy. I guess that's not quite as bad.
I don't give a damn what he says. He can...
Go ahead. The uncle looked at him warily. He flipped the tiny stub of his cigarette out the door.
Well, he said, he don't know everything.
Look, said Sutri, leaning forward, when a man marries beneath him, his children are beneath him, if he thinks that way at all. If you weren't a drunk, he might see me with different eyes. As it is, my case was always doubtful. I was expected to turn out badly. My grandfather used to say, blood will tell. It was his favorite saying. What are you looking at? Look at me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, you do. I'm saying that my father is contemptuous of me because I'm related to you. Don't you think that's a fair statement?
I don't know why you try and blame me for your troubles. You and your crackpot theories.
Sutri reached across the little space and took his uncle's willowing hands and composed them.
I don't blame you, he said. I just want to tell you how some people are. I know how people are. I should know.
Why should you? You think my father and his kind are a race apart? You can laugh at their pretensions, but you never question their right to the way of life they maintain.
He puts his pants on the same way I do mine. Bullshit, John. You don't even believe that. I said it, didn't I?
What do you suppose he thinks of his wife?
They get along okay. They get along okay. Yeah.
John, she's a housekeeper. He has no real belief even in her goodness. Can't you guess that he sees in her traces of the same sorriness he sees in you? An innocent gesture can call you to mind.
Don't call me sorry, said the uncle.
He probably believes that only his own benevolent guidance kept her out of the whorehouse.
That's my sister you're talking about, boy.
She's my mother, you maudlin sot. Sudden quiet in the little cabin. The uncle rose, shaking. His voice was low.
They were right, he said, what they told me. They were right about you. You are a vicious person. A nasty, vicious person.
Sutri sat with his forehead in his hands. The uncle moved warily to the door. His shadow fell across Sutri, and Sutri raised his head.
Maybe it's like color blindness, he said. The women are just carriers. You are color blind, aren't you? At least I'm not crazy.
No, Sutri said. Not crazy. The uncle's narrowed eyes seemed to soften.
God help you, he said.
He turned and stepped onto the catwalk and went down the boards. Sutri rose and went to the door. The uncle was crossing the fields in the last of the day's light toward the darkening city.
John, he called.
He looked back. But that old man seemed so glassed away in worlds of his own contrivance that Sutri only raised his hand. The uncle nodded like a man who understood, and then went on. The cabin was almost dark, and Sutri walked around on a little deck and kicked up a stool and sat leaning back against the wall of the houseboat with his feet propped on the railing. A breeze was coming off the river, bearing a faint odor of oil and fish. Night sounds and laughter drifted from the yellow shacks beyond the rail spur, and the river spooled past high-backed and hissing in the dark at his feet, like the seething of sand in a glass, wind in a desert, the slow voice of ruin. He wedged his knuckles in his eye sockets and rested his head against the boards. They were still warm from the sun, like a faint breath at his nape. Across the river, the lights of the lumber company lay foreshort and dismembered in the black water, and downriver the strung bridge lamps hung in catenary replica shore to shore and softly guttering under the wind's faint chop. The tower clock in the courthouse tolled the half hour. Lonely bell in the city, a firefly there and there. He rose and spat into the river and went down the catwalk to the shore and across the field toward the road. He walked up Front Street, breathing in the cool of the evening, the western sky before him still a deep cyanic blue, shot through with the shapes of bats crossing blind and spastic like spores on a slide. A rank smell of boiled greens hung in the night, and a thread of radio music followed him house by house. He went by yards and cinder gardens, rank with the mutes of roosting fowls, and by dark grottos among the shacks where the music flared and died again, and past dim window lights where shadows reeled down cracked and yellowed paper shades. Through reeking clabbered warrens, where children cried and craven half-bald watchdogs yapped and slank. He climbed the hill toward the edge of the city, past the open door of the Negro meeting house, softly lit within. A preacher that looked like a storybook blackbird in his suit and gold-wire spectacles. Sutri coming up out of his hot and funky netherworld attended by gospel music. Dusky throats tilted and veined like the welted flanks of horses. He has watched them summer nights, a pale pagan sat on the curb without. One rainy night nearby he heard news in his tooth fillings, music softly. He was stayed in a peace that drained his mind, for even a false adumbration of the world of the spirit is better than none at all. Up these steep walkways, cannelured for foot purchase, the free passage of roaches. To tap at this latched door, leaning. Jimmy Smith's brown rodent teeth just beyond the screen. There is a hole in the rotten fabric which perhaps his breath has made over the years. Down a long hallway lit by a single sulfur-colored light bulb hung from a cord in the ceiling. Smith's shuffling slippers rasp over the linoleum. He turns at the end of the hall, holding the door there, the slack yellow skin of his shoulders and chest so bloodless and lined that he appears patched up out of odd scraps and remnants of flesh, tacked with lap seams and carefully bound in the insubstantial and foul gray web of his undershirt. In the little kitchen, two men are sitting at a table drinking whiskey. A third leans against a stained refrigerator. There is an open door giving onto a porch, a small buckled portico of gray boards that hangs in the dark above the river. The rise and fall of cigarettes tells the occupants. There are sounds of laughter, and a bloated whore looks out into the kitchen and goes away again. "What do you have, Sut?"
"A beer."
The man leaning against the refrigerator moves slightly to one side.
"What say, bud?" he says.
"Hey, Junior." Jimmy Smith has opened a can of beer and holds it toward Sutri. He pays, and the owner deals up change out of his loathsome breeks and counts the coins into Sutri's palm and shuffles away. "Who's back in the back?"
"Bunch of drunks. Brothers back there."
Sutri tipped a swallow of the beer against the back of his throat. It was cold and good.
"Well," he said, "let me go back there and see him."
He nodded to the two men at the table and went past and down the corridor and entered an enormous old drawing room with high sliding doors, long painted fast in their tracks. Five men sat at a card table. None looked up. The room was otherwise barren. a white marble fireplace masked with a sheet of tin, old varnished wainscoting and a high-stamped rococo ceiling with parched scrolls and beaded drops of brazing about the gas jet where a light bulb now burned. Surrounded as they were in this crazed austerity by the remnants of a former grandeur, the poker players seemed themselves like shades of older times or rude impostors on a stage set. They drank and bet and muttered in an air of electric transiency, old men in gaitered sleeves, galvanized from some stained sepia, posting time at cards, prevenient of their dimly augured doom. Sutri passed on through. In the front room was a broken sofa propped on bricks, nothing more. One wonky spring reared from the back with a beer can seized in its coils, and deeply couched in the mouse-colored and napless upholstery sat a row of drunks.
"Hey, Sutri," they called. "God damn," said J-Bone, surging from the bowels of the couch.
He threw an arm around Sutri's shoulders.
"Here's my old buddy," he said. "Where's the whiskey? Give him a drink of that old crazy shit."
"How you doing, Jim?"
"I'm doing everybody I can. Where you been? Where's the whiskey? Here you go. Get you a drink, bud."
"What is it?"
"Early Times. Best little old drink in the world. Get you a drink, Sut."
Sutri held it to the light. Small twigs, debris, matter coiled in the oily liquid. He shook it. Smoke rose from the yellow floor of the bottle.
"Shit almighty," he said. "Best little old drink in the world," sang out J-Bone. "Have a drink, bud."
He unthreaded the cap, sniffed, shivered, drank. J-Bone hugged the drinking figure.
"Watch old Sutri take a drink," he called out.
Sutri's eyes were squeezed shut, and he was holding the bottle out to whoever would take it.
"God damn, what is that shit?" "Early Times," called J-Bone. "Best little old drink there is. Drink that and you won't feel a thing the next morning."
"Or any morning."
"Woo, Lord, give it here. Hello, Early. Come to your old daddy."
"Here, pour some of it in this cup and let me cut it with Coca-Cola."
"Can't do it, bud."
"Why not?"
"We done tried it. It eats the bottom out." "Watch it, Sutri. Don't spill none on your shoes."
"Hey, Bobby John. When's old Callahan getting out?" said Bobby John. "I don't know. Sometime this month." "When have you seen Bucket?"
"He's moved to Burlington, the Bucket has. He don't come round no more." "Come set with us, Sut."
J-Bone steered him by the arm.
"Set down, bud, set down."
Sutri eased himself down on the arm of the sofa and sipped his beer. He patted J-Bone on the back. The voices seemed to fade. He waved away the whiskey bottle with a smile. In this tall room, the cracked plaster, soot-streaked with the shapes of laths beneath, this barrenness, this fellowship of the doomed, where life pulsed obscenely fecund. In the drift of voices and the laughter and the reek of stale beer, the Sunday loneliness seeped away.
"Ain't that right, Sutri?"
"What's that?"
"About there being caves all in under the city."
"That's right."
"What's all down there in 'em?"
"Blind slime. As above, so it is below." Sutri shrugged. "Nothing that I know of," he said. "They're just some caves."
"They say there's one that runs plumb underneath the river. That's the one that comes out over in Chihaui Park. They were supposed to have used it in the Civil War to hide stuff down there. Wonder what's all down in there now." "Shit if I know," asked Sutri.
"You reckon you can still get down in them Civil War caves, Sut?" "I don't know. I always heard there was one ran under the river, but I never heard of anybody that was ever in it.
There might be them Civil War relics down there." "Here comes one of them now," said J-Bone. "What say, nigger?"
Sutri looked toward the door. A gray-looking man in glasses was watching them.
"I can't say," he said. "How you boys? What are you drinking?
Early times, Jim says it is.
Get ye a drink, Neg.
He shuffled toward the bottle, nodding to all, small eyes moving rapidly behind the glasses. He seized the whiskey and drank, his slack gullet jerking. When he lowered it, his eyes were closed and his face a twisted mask.
Phew.
He blew a volatile mist toward the smiling watchers.
Lord God, what is that? Early times, Nig, cried J-Bone.
Early tombs is more like it.
Lord, honey, I know they make that old splow in the bathtub, but this here is made in the toilet.
He was looking at the bottle, shaking it. Bubbles the size of goose shot veered greasily up through the smoky fuel it held.
It'll make you drunk, said J-Bone.
Nig shook his head and blew and took another drink and handed over the bottle with his face averted in agony. When he could speak, he said,
Boys, I've fought some bad whiskey, but I'm a dirty nigger if that there ain't almost too sorry to drink.
J-Bone waved the bottle toward the door where Junior stood grinning.
Brother, don't you want a drink?
Junior shook his head.
Boys, scoot over and let the old nigger set down.
Here, Nig, set here. Scoot over some, Bear Hunter.
Lord, boys, if I ain't plumb give out.
He took off his glasses and wiped his weepy eyes.
What you been up to, Nig? I've been trying to raise some money about Bobby.
He turned and looked up at Sutry.
Don't I know you?
He said. We drank a few beers together.
I thought I remembered ye. Did you not know Bobby?
I saw him a time or two. Nigger shook his head reflectively.
I'll raise four boys, and damned if they ain't all in the penitentiary except Ralph. Of course, we all went to Jordonia. And they did have me up here in the workhouse one time, but I slipped off. Old Blackburn was guard up there, knowed me, but he never would say nothing. Was you in Jordonia? Clarence says there ain't nothing to it now. Boys, when I was in there, it was rougher than an old cob. Of course, they didn't send you there for singing in a choir. I'd done 3 years for stealing. Tried to get sent to TSI where they learn you a trade, but you had to be tardy to get in down there, and they said I wasn't tardy. I was 18 when I come out of Jordonia, and that was in 1916. I wished I could understand them boys of mine. They have costed me. I spent $18,000 getting them boys out. Their granddaddy was never in the least trouble that you could think of, and he lived to be 87 years old. Now, he'd take a drink, which I'd do myself, but he was never in no trouble with the law. Get ye a drink, Sut.
Nigger intercepted the bottle.
You know, Jim, he's a fine boy. Don't think he ain't. I wished McAnally Flats was full of them just like him. I knowed his daddy. He was smaller than Junior yonder. Just a minute. Phew! Damn, that ain't some whiskey. He wouldn't take nothing off nobody. Irish Long wouldn't. I remember he come over on what they used to call Woolen Mill Corners there one time. You know where it's at, Jim? Where Workers' Cafe is at. Come over there one Sunday morning hunting a man, and there was a bunch of tush hogs all standing around out there under a shed. Used to be there, you boys wouldn't remember it, drinking whiskey, and was friends of this old boy's. And Irish Long walked up to them and wanted to know where he's at. Well, they wouldn't say. But they wasn't a one of them tush hogs asked what he wanted with him. He would mortally whip your ass if you messed with him, Irish Long would. And there wasn't nobody in McAnally no better-hearted. He'd give away everything he owned. He'd have been rich if he wanted. Had them stores. Nobody didn't have no money. People couldn't buy the groceries. You boys don't remember the Depression. He'd tell them just go on and get what they needed. Flour and taters. Milk for the babies.
He never turned down nobody, Irish Long, never. They is people living in this town today in big houses that would have starved plumb to death except for him, but they ain't big enough to own it. Better get you a drink there, Sut, for a nigger drinks it all.
Give Bear Hunter a drink, Suttree said.
How about giving Bobby John a drink,
said Bobby John.
There's a man'll take a drink, said Nigger. Don't think he won't. Which I will myself, said J-Bone. Which I will my damn self, said Nigger.
Jimmy Smith was moving through the room like an enormous trained mole collecting the empty cans. He shuffled out, his small eyes blinking. Kenneth Hazelwood stood in the doorframe, watching them all with a sardonic smile.
Come in here, worm, called J-Bone. Get ye a drink of this good whiskey.
Hazelwood entered smiling and took the bottle. He tilted it and sniffed and gave it back.
The last time I drank some of that shit, I'd like to died. I stunk from the inside out. I laid in a tub of hot water all day and climbed out and dried, and you could still smell it. I had to burn my clothes. I had the dry heaves, the drizzling shits, the cold shakes, and the jank leg. I can think about it now and feel bad. Hell, worm, this is good whisk. I pass. Worm's put down my whiskey, bud. I think you better put it down before it puts you down. You'll find your liver in your socks some morning.
But J-Bone had turned away with a whoop.
Early times, he called. Make your liver quiver.
Hazelwood grinned and turned to Suttree.
Can't you take no better care of him than that, he said.
Suttree shook his head.
Me and Catherine's going out to the Trocadero. Come on, go with us.
I better get home, Kenneth.
Come right out there with us. We'll bring you back.
I remember the last time I went for a ride with you. You got us in 3 fights, kicked some woman's door in, and got in jail. I ran through some yards and like to hung myself on a clothesline and got a bunch of dogs after me and spotlights zipping around and cops all over the place, and I wound up spending the night in a corrugated conduit with a cat. Worm grinned.
Come on, he said. We'll just have a drink and see what all's going on out there.
I can't, Kenneth. I'm broke anyway.
I didn't ask you if you had any money.
Hey, Worm, did you see old Crumbless in the paper this morning?
What's he done now?
They found him about 6 o'clock this morning under a tree in a big alfalfa field. He found the only tree in the whole field and run into it. They said when the cops come and opened the door, old Crumbless fell out and just laid there. Directly he looked up and seen them blue suits, and he jumped up and hollered, said, "Where is that man I hired to drive me home?" Suttree rose, grinning.
Don't run off, Sut.
I've got to go.
Where you going?
I've got to get something to eat. I'll see you all later. Jimmy Smith fell in with him to see him to the door, down the long corridor, mole and guest, an unlatching of the screen door, and so into the night. It is overcast with impending rain, and the lights of the city wash against the curdled heavens, lie puddled in the wet black streets. The water truck recedes down Locust with its footmen in their tattered oilskins wielding brooms in the flooded gutters, and the air is rich with the odor of damp paving. Through the midnight emptiness, the few sounds carry with amphoric hollow, and the city in its quietude seems to lie under edict. The buildings lean upon the dim and muted corridors where the watchman's heels click away the minutes. Past black and padlocked shop fronts, a poultry dresser's window where half-naked cockerels nod in a constant blue dawn. Clock chime and bell toll lonely in the brooding sleep-fast town. The gutted rusting trucks on Market Street with their splayed tires pooling on the tar. The flowers and fruit are gone and the sewer grates festooned with wilted greens. Under the fanned light of a street lamp, a white china cup handle curled like a sleeping slug. In the lobbies of the slattern hotels, the porters and bellmen are napping in the chairs and lounges, dark faces jerking in their sleep down the worn wine plush. In the rooms lie drunken homecome soldiers, sprawled in painless crucifixion on the rumpled counterpanes, and the whores are sleeping now. Small tropic fish start and check in the moss-green deeps of the eye doctor's shop window. A lynx, rampant with a waxen snarl. Gouts of shredded wood sprout from the sutures in his leather belly, and his glass eyes bulge in agony. Dim tavern, an alley mouth where ash cans gape, and where in a dream I was stopped by a man I took to be my father, dark figure against the shadowed brick. I would go by, but he has stayed me with his hand.
"I've been looking for you," he said.
The wind was cold. Dream winds are so. I had been hurrying. I would draw back from him and his bone grip. The knife he held severed the pallid lamplight like a thin blue fish, and our footsteps amplified themselves in the emptiness of the streets to an echo of routed multitudes. Yet it was not my father, but my son who accosted me with such rancorless intent. On Gay Street, the traffic lights are stilled. The trolley rails gleam in their beds, and a late car passes with a long slish of tires. In the long arcade of the bus station, footfalls come back like laughter. He marches darkly toward his darkly marching shape in the glass of the depot door. His fetch come up from life's other side like an autoscopic hallucination, sutri and anti-sutri, hand reaching to the hand. The door swung back, and he entered the waiting room. The shapes of figures sleeping on the wooden benches lay like laundry. In the men's room, an elderly pederast leaning against a wall. Sutri washed his hands and went out past the pinball machines to the grill. He took a stool and studied the menu. The waitress stood tapping her pencil against the pad of tickets she held. Sutri looked up. "Grilled cheese and coffee," she wrote. He watched. She tore off the ticket and placed it face down on the marble counter and moved away. He watched the shape of her underclothes through the thin white uniform. In the rear of the cafe, a young black labored in a clatter of steaming crockery. Sutri rubbed his eyes. She came with the coffee, setting it down with a click, and the coffee tilting up the side of the pink plastic cup and flooding the saucer. He poured it back and sipped. Acridity of burnt socks. She returned with napkin, spoon, ring of gold orange blossoms constricting her puffy finger. He took another sip of the coffee. In a few minutes, she came with the sandwich. He held the first wedge of it to his nose for a minute, rich odor of toast and butter and melting cheese. He bit off an enormous mouthful, sucked the pickle from the toothpick, and closed his eyes, chewing. When he had finished, he took the quarter from his pocket and laid it on the counter and rose. She was watching him from beyond the coffee urn. "You want some more coffee?" she said.
"No, thank you."
"Come back," she said. Sutri shoved the door with his shoulder, one hand in his pocket, the other working the toothpick. A face rose from a near bench and looked at him blearily and subsided. He walked along Gay Street, pausing by store windows, fine goods kept in glass. A police cruiser passed slowly. He moved on, from out of his eye corner, watching them watch. Past Woodruff's, Clark and Jones, the theaters. Corners emptied of their news peddlers and trash scuttling in the wind. He went down to the end of the town and walked out on the bridge and placed his hands on the cool iron rail and looked at the river below. The bridge lights trembled in the black eddy water like chained and burning supplicants, and along the riverfront, a gray mist moved in over the ashen fields of sedge and went ferreting among the dwellings. He folded his arms on the rail. Out there, a jumbled, shack-strewn waste dimly lit. Kindling wood cottages, gardens of rue, a patchwork of roofs, canted under the pale blue cones of lamplight where moths aspire in giddy coils. Little plots of corn, warped purlieus of tillage in the dead spaces, shaped by constriction and want like the lives of the dark and bitter husbandsmen who have this sparse harvest for their own out of all the wide earth's keeping. Small spills of rain had started, cold on his arm. Downstream recurving shore currents chased in decal light, wave on wave, like silver spawn, to fall through dark to darkness. Struggle in those opaque and fecal deeps which weighs up, till the lungs suck brown sewage, and funny lights go down the final corridors of the brain, small watchmen to see that all is quiet for the advent of eternal night. The courthouse clock tolled two. He raised his face. There you can see the illumined dial suspended above the town, with not even a shadow to mark the tower. A Cheshire clock hung in the void like a strange hieroglyphic moon. Sutri palmed the water from his face. The smoky yellow window light in the houseboat of Abednego Jones went dark. Below, he could make out the shape of his own place where he must go. High over the downriver land, lightning quaked soundlessly and ceased. Far clouds, rimlit, a brimstone light. Are there dragons in the wings of the world? The rain was falling harder, falling past him toward the river. Steep rain leaning in the lamplight across the clock's face. Hard weather, says the old man. So may it be. Wrap me in the weathers of the earth, I will be hard and hard. My face will turn rain like the stones. He came up from the back lot, threading his way among the shapes of cast-off and broken and useless debris rotting under the late summer sun. Old tires and bricks and broken jars. A rusty chicken feeder. He squinched his nose at the rank odor of wash water in the air, and he threw a rock he was carrying at the tethered goat. The goat raised its chin from the grass and looked at him with its strange goat's eyes and lowered its head to graze again. He went on around the corner of the house to the front porch where a green and white washing machine shuddered and churned and over which stood a young woman with a soapy paddle clubbed in her hands as if defying the first insurgent rag to rear from the slate-blue and foamless water in which the week's wash moiled.
"Had it," he said.
She moved, her weight bringing up out of the spongy boards beneath her shoes a black seepage. She did not look nor answer.
"Oh, Norval ain't been by, is he?"
She laid the paddle across the washer, where it slurred in concatenate images with the motion of the machine, and began to slide off slowly. She wiped her forehead with the hem of her apron.
"No," she said, "he ain't been here."
He looked toward the open door of the house.
"What does she want now?"
he said.
"What do you care?" "I just asked."
She didn't answer. He propped his foot on the porch and spat, watching out across the dead clay yard at nothing at all. The paddle dropped to the floor, and she stooped and got it and began to dig at the clothes, her breasts pendulous and bobbing with the movement of her shoulders. Blue curded wash water dripped from the end of the porch into a puddle of gray scum. When she looked at him, he had not moved. She tossed her hair and tilted one shoulder forward, blotting the sweat from her upper lip. She pouted and blew the hair from her eyes.
"Why don't you grub some of them weeds out of the tomatoes for me if you ain't got nothing else to do?" she said.
He sat down facing out across the yard. He put one finger in his ear and jiggled it, and she bent to the washer again. After a while, a thin voice came again from the rear of the house. She stopped and looked at him.
"See what she wants, will you?"
He spat.
"I didn't take her to raise," he said.
She lifted her bleached and wrinkled hands from the water and wiped them on the front of her dress.
"All right, Mama," she called. "Just a minute."
When she came back out, he was hanging by his elbows in the wire fence that ran along the little lane the house faced, and he was talking to another boy. They left together. He came back for his supper and went out again and stayed until past dark. Just before midnight, she heard him leave the house again. He listened at her door and then went on to the front room, where he sat on the daybed and donned his shoes. Then he was out in the warm August night, lush and tactile, the door set shut with a faint cry of the keeper spring, down the path through the gate and into the lane. When he came out on the pike, he could feel the day's warmth from the macadam through his thin shoe soles, and he could smell it, musky and faintly antiseptic. He went up the pike at a jog. He went solitary and starlit through the sleep-fast countryside, trotting soundlessly on his soft-worn shoes, past dead houses and dark land with the odor of ripe and humid fruits breathing in the fields and night birds crying in the keep of enormous trees. The road climbed up out of the woods and went on through farmland, and he slowed to a walk, his hands slung in his hip pockets and his elbows flapping, taking a dirt road down to the right, padding along soft as a dog, sniffing the rank grass and the odor of dust the dew had laid. He crossed the tracks of the railway and loped into the growth on the far side, wiping his nose with his sleeve as he went, and casting his eyes about, passing along a high revetment of honeysuckle, and then through a patch of cane, and coming at last along the edge of a field, where his old tracks had packed the clay in a furrow you could follow in the dark, and his shape washed shadowless across a backdrop of sumac and sassafras. He could see the house beyond in darkness against the star-blown sky, and the barn behind it rising outsize and stark. He was going along the troughs in the heavy-turned earth, past cornrows, the shell-brown spears of his arms with fine teeth, into the open field where the melons lay. There were no more than a quarter acre of them, a long black rectangle set along the edge of the corn in which, by the meager starlight of late summer, he could see the plump forms supine and dormant in spaced rows. He listened. In the distance, a dog was yapping, and in his keen ears, the blind passage of gnats sounded incessantly. He knelt in the rich and steaming earth, his nostrils filled with the winy smell of ruptured melons. To steal upon them where they lay, his hand on their warm, ripe shapes, his pocket-knife open. He lifted one, a pale jade underbelly turning up. He pulled it between his knees and sank the blade of the knife into its nether end. He shucked off the straps of his overalls, his pale shanks kneeling in a pool of denim. A whippoorwill had begun to call, and with his ear to the ground this way, he began to hear the train, too. A star arced long and dying down the sky. He raised his head and looked toward the house. Nothing moved. The train had come on, and her harpy-throated highball wailed down the lonely summer night. He could hear the wheels shucking along the rails, and he could feel the ground shudder, and he could hear the tone of the trucks shift at the crossing, and the huffing breath of the boiler, and the rattle and clank and wheel-click and coupling clacking, and then the last long shunting on the downgrade, drawing on toward the distance, and a low moan bawling across the sleeping land and fading, and the caboose clicking away to final silence. He rose and adjusted his clothes and went back along the rows of corn to the woods and to the road and set himself toward home again. Brogans stood in the tracks he left, walking up, back, turning, towing the bunged melons lying in the sun, a slow spout of black ants pluming forth, a yellow jacket. He came again that night. In a persimmon tree at the edge of the field, a mockingbird whistled him back, but he would not hear. Down past the corn he came, and into the dark of the melon patch with stark wooden lubricity, looking once toward the lightless house, and then going to his knees in the rich and wine-slaked loam. When the light of the sealed beam cut over the field, he was lying prone upon a watermelon with his overalls about his knees. The beam swept past, stopped, returned to fix upon his alabaster nates looming moon-like out of the dark. He rose vertically, pale, weightless, like some grim Tellurian wraith, up over the violated fruit with arms horrible and off across the fields, hauling wildly at the folds of old rank denim that hobbled him. "Hold it!" a voice called. He had no ear for such news. The dry bracken that rimmed the field crashed about him. He crossed the stand of cane in a series of diminishing reports and went over the top of the honeysuckle in graceful levitation and lit in the road in the lights of a car rounding the curve. The car braked and slewed in the gravel, a crazed figure dressing on the run, blown out of the dark wall of summer green and into the road. In the distance, the train called for the crossing.